So this morning we'll zoom in on verses 9 to 13. I just thought it was helpful to give us that little bit of lead in into that place and remind us where we came from. Last week we sort of deviated a little bit, not in any naughty ways, but in thinking about prayer. But we didn't really pull apart this little passage. It was mentioned in terms of the faithfulness in prayer, but other than that, we didn't really talk about it. And so I've tried to pick up some of these words because I think I just felt that it was important really for this morning and gives us that sense of continuity. So if you've been with us for our little series on Romans, we begin by, at the beginning of this chapter, understanding that out of a place of unity that Paul calls us to this place of intimate discernment, that actually that we recognize that there is a pattern of evil and destruction in the world, that actually there are ways that we can walk which are destructive, that those patterns are often destructive, and that actually we've got this imperative to find a different way to do that, and it's non-conformity, and it comes out of a place of intimacy, that we don't abide in those senses, but we live with God as close as we can, choosing, walking with him. And out of that place, then we recognize that though we are complete in ourselves, that we are absolutely able to be one body in ourselves and work out God's ministry in that way, but that actually we recognize that we are also called to one another. With Jesus at the head of his church, that we're called to be a body together, that we're called and recognized in that way, that we're to be bodies within the church, and that we're to be a body in the kingdom as well, that we work together in all of those ways, and that God is interested in the way that we do that. He pulls us together in that way. As we recognize, the last time I spoke, Paul writes about this image of the body in a couple of different places, and the other place that you probably recognize it from is 1 Corinthians 12, that there's a little passage there that is obviously the same imagery here, Paul writing it to different occasions, to two different people, but he obviously likes this image. He finds this image helpful in terms of helping us understand what it is that we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to live. But there's a really interesting parallel here between these two passages. So what Paul says is that out of a place of unity, out of a place of discovering that you're one body, well, what comes next? Well, in 1 Corinthians 12, what comes next is 1 Corinthians 13, which is a passage that I probably don't need to remind you of, because if you've been married, or if you've ever attended a wedding, I'm pretty sure it's compulsory to read 1 Corinthians 13, which talks about the value of love. It says that if we have love, we are nothing, is the conclusion of that lovely, lovely passage that with which we are, I'm quite sure, familiar. If you're not familiar with it, well, how on earth have you managed not to be, I guess, is my question to you. So have a look at that. But that's the place that he leads. And then look what he does here. And there's something particular. There's a change in language here that Paul uses in talking about this image of the body out of this place of unity, out of this place of working together. Again, Paul steers us towards love. And if you're like me in that you don't read New Testament Greek, and I don't, as far as I know, nobody else here does, but do let me know if you do, because you can help me with some of these things. He changes his language. At all of these next statements, so this love must be sincere onwards, so from verse 9 to 13 at least, are participles that come as imperatives. Now, that's not important. I don't know what that means really, but what I do know is that Paul is participating in this style of speaking, in this kind of ancient tradition of speaking that says, using this particular form of grammar, he's saying, here are a series of statements that need to come to you almost as commandments. Okay, that's the way that he intends this language. He's participating in this ancient technique and saying, here's a list of things. I think there is a huge question here as well as to how these fit together, because I think, the more I look at this, the more I understand this, I think the way that Paul structures this, and again, there are lots of others that would agree with me, and I have been persuaded by them, that love must be sincere sits as a little banner over them. So that's the way I'm going to treat this, is that we've got this little statement, love must be sincere, and we'll try and understand that a little bit in the language that's used, but that everything else that comes as a result actually comes as a result of that, that actually we're qualifying our statement, love must be sincere, by then what comes next. Do you see how we're structuring this? So that's what I want you to have in your mind. That's the way I'm interpreting. I'm sure you can interpret each little statement on its own. Each little statement on its own absolutely has its own merit. But what I'm choosing to do is interpret each of those out of that beginning place. Okay? So I just want to warn you of that as we begin. So, as we begin, love must be sincere. Love must be sincere. Love must be genuine. Actually, we can pull apart this word a little more and say that we mustn't be hypocrites in terms of our love. Have you ever been hypocritical in love? Blimey. We start wriggling, don't we, at this point, and just think, ooh. Love must be genuine, sincere, that we must avoid hypocrisy in our love. For me, this was all about, well, actually, it was quite a lot about the way that Honshi helped us with our children's talk this morning. Because I think we're very prepared to love those who it's easy to love. And I don't need to list those people for you because you find it easy to love lots of different people. We find it easy to love people that are similar to us. Sometimes we find it easy to love people that are completely different to us, but sometimes we find it difficult to love across social boundaries. Sometimes we find it difficult to love across culture. Sometimes we find it difficult to love because of what people have done. But love must be genuine. Love must be genuine. How do we face ourselves up to that kind of statement? How do we hold ourselves accountable to that so that actually we understand that love is something that we all are capable of, something that we are to do, and that actually it's not just our love, but it's a way of understanding God's love. Because the word for love here is agape. This is the word that God has given, you know, this is about God's love for us, our love for God. It's about that interaction of his love for us, how we respond to that. Love must be genuine. It's about how we reflect that love horizontally to one another. Love must be genuine. I think my main thought about this was actually, we know when love is insincere. That actually we can read it in one another when actually the message isn't quite there, when it's actually not coming from a place of heart. That actually we can discern that quite easily, that we're not easily fooled when it comes to love, because you know if you are loved, don't you? Because you feel something within you when you are loved by somebody, whether it's an act of love, whether it's a gift out of love, whatever it is, you are able to discern that because you know. And when that love has been corrupted somehow, when that love has become false, when that love lies, when it becomes distorted in any fashion, we feel it. We feel that tension within us. We feel that pain sometimes within us. But here is a banner that says love must be genuine. And actually then if we receive the rest of these statements as then how we work out, how are we supposed to live out love that is genuine? Well, we follow these next statements. How do we know that love is genuine? Well, we hate what is evil and we cling to what is good. That's a nice beginning statement, isn't it? And I think Paul is equally pointing back to gifting here, that actually we understand that we can measure a lot of things by discerning that which is evil and that which is good, that we can hold ourselves accountable in that kind of way. I think all that Paul is pointing to here is having a sense of that which is building up, something which is good, and that which is diminishing away. And I think we see that. We know that love is genuine when people draw together in love, when we recognize that they are growing in love, when people are combined, you know, when they see something different. That's when we know something is good. When love is in action, it draws people together. It draws either them together or that they see God somehow through that, because God works his love out in community. He works it out in relationships. So when love is good, it either brings people together or it brings them closer to God, or both. That's how we know when something is good, because something happens, because love is effective enough that it disturbs a situation. If something's going on for you, if you're in the middle of a crisis of any kind, if I come into that situation and I love you, whatever that means, whether that's just listening, whether that's doing, whatever it is, whatever if I love you in that situation, the hope is that some love would somehow grow, either between me and you or between you and God, and hopefully both of those things. Because love is affective in that way. Love changes everything, I think as the song says. It does. So love is affective in that way. Equally, when things are going bad, when things are not done out of love, well, things deteriorate. That there is that sense of division. Unity in itself begins to be lost. We actually, and we see evidence of that destruction and pain. Again, just as a body is damaged, if we misuse a body, it's damaged, it's torn, it's hurt. And it's that same picture that we've got here. That's what happens when we don't love, when there is an absence of love. So, therefore, we hold on to, we persevere with, we cling to that which is good. And we hate, despise, push away, get rid of that which is bad. That's a good measure of how we're to do things. I think that's just a really simple way of understanding what that means. We know that love works in lots of different ways. And actually that even though we're dealing here in something that is very simple, that actually it seems simple, doesn't it, that if you're in pain, I can just love you and everything will be all right. I don't think Paul means it as simply as that. Because actually love is complex. Love is hard. We need to understand what tough love is sometimes. But all of those things come out of a place of relationship. And again, Paul points us back. Paul is so, so clear here that at the heart of love is relationship. Paul is completely an insight over every single one of these verses is a deep and intimate relationship with God and pointing towards an intimate relationship with one another. That's absolutely in his sight as he's speaking here. Love is difficult sometimes. It can be radical, it can be controversial. Genuine love is costly. He carries on. Love must be sincere. Banner. Hate what is evil, cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Again, the language changes here. Again, we need to remember, and I'm sure many of us here know, that the word for love is actually a translation of several different words in the Greek. So we've moved from agape, so love must be genuine. That's agape love. We're to be devoted to one another in Philadelphia. That doesn't mean that we need to move to Philadelphia. It doesn't mean that we need to become obsessed with soft cheese. But Philadelphia, that word for love, speaks to us about brother familial love, actually. It's often translated as brotherly love, but actually it's much wider than that. It's actually family love. We're to be devoted to one another. Well, again, the word devoted is another word that sort of comes out of the word love, that same word. It's like we're to love one another into a place of family love. it's kind of the trajectory of this little statement. But there's also affection in there. So that actually we're to become, that we're to give ourselves, that we're to become affectionate for one another out of that sense of being family with one another. And then you add to that devotion, which means that it's consistent, doesn't it? That actually it's committed and consistent with one another. Again, love must be genuine. We know what genuine love is by discerning what's good and evil. It either brings people together, brings things together, or divides things. That's how we measure it. How then are we to work it out? Well, actually, we're to push ourselves towards one another, that we're to devote ourselves to one another, that we're to find this place of family with one another. And that's in itself a challenge, isn't it? That's costly, that's serious, that it's committed, that it's consistent. We're to be devoted to one another out of that place of familial love. We're to give our affections to one another. It's that we're very clearly talking about that horizontal love, how we connect with one another. People will listen and understand when we show love, when they receive our affections. And if that's done out of an attempt to be devoted to God, then the equation that is created is left open. It needs solving. That when we love people, there's an answer that's needed. And the answer is to the question is somewhere between Alpha and Omega, isn't it? That actually somehow when we love people, they're pointed towards the beginning and the end. They're pointed towards the Creator. This isn't lip service kind of love, is it? This is deeper. This is more serious that Paul is talking about. Okay, so genuine love. Test it. How do we work it out? Well, part of it is Philadelphia. What else is it? We're to honor one another above ourselves. There's a lovely old translation of this and several others that work along similar lines because it's kind of permitted in its original language, or the language that we've received, that we're to compete with one another in order to honor and respect each other. That actually it's a competition, that there is, isn't that a lovely little turn of, that we're to compete with one another in order to do honor to one another. How about that for a challenge? My problem with this is I don't think we'd ever get out of a door. You know that business that you said, no, after you, my dear, is that kind of situation, isn't that the problem that we might, but it's not a lovely problem to have. What if we were to compete with one another in order to honor one another, in order to show one another respect? That's a great competition, isn't it? And I don't think there's any winners or losers in that, by the way. That's not the language that Paul's using here. But actually, it gives us that sense of, come on, let's do that. And who is Paul talking about at this point? Because actually, I could very easily fancy having a competition with you to try and give you honor and respect. Because I know all of you in different ways. And I find it very easy to love you all because I know you, even if it's just a small amount. That's not a challenge. What if the challenge is actually out there somewhere? It's in our ordinary lives. What if that competition is spread further than this building and the people that we associate with in this place? It becomes a bit more difficult then, doesn't it? Because they might not play the competition. They might not be competing with you. They may have never showed you honor and respect. Doesn't that raise the game? But again, what's Paul saying? If it's genuine love, the competition is on. If it's genuine love, that competition is big and it's broad and it's for the people that we like. It's for the people that we don't like. honor one another above yourself. Honor one another. Genuine love, devotion, spreading it around. That sense of honoring one another. Where does Paul go next? He says, never be lacking in zeal in this translation, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Never be lacking in zeal. That's not a word we use very often. That seems to be a very Christian word to me. Have you ever used the word zeal outside of your church community? I'm not sure I have, if I'm honest, unless I've been talking about things on the beach. Yeah, you got there. I think there's two sides to this. I think there is, first of all, that sense of imminence which cannot be escaped, that sense of an urgency in love. I sometimes think we've got our theology of the end times a bit skewed. What the early church recognized was that Jesus would come again, and they were saying, well, Jesus is going to come again soon, that feels like something that's going to happen any time now. And it's not because they knew, it's just that they sensed that urgency. They really understood that the whole world was pregnant in waiting. And that's the words that Paul uses in Thessalonians, I think it is, isn't it? He says that it's pregnant in waiting and that it's inevitable, that we know that it's going to come, but it'll come at a time that nobody will know. And they've got this kind of theology of how things are going to turn out in the future to the point where it says, well, look, Jesus is coming again, and I know it's going to happen, therefore actually I need to do something about that. That actually that sense of urgency in terms of how I love you and how I work in the world, how I become active in the world, is something that's really important, and it's now. That actually I can't really wait a minute, I can't put off that sense of what's going on, because actually Jesus is coming again. And therefore, that's why I say, I wonder sometimes whether we have caught on to this sense of urgency because our theology is deficient. Yes, we do not know when Jesus will come again. We don't. But we need to live and expect that Jesus might come again now. We need to recognize and understand that he could come now. That he might come, I'm hoping, now. We settle into this place of, well, this is 2,000 years later and he's not come again, so therefore it's not going to happen, don't we? Isn't that the mentality that we have with these things, that we've somehow fooled ourselves into thinking that just because it's 2,000 years later or so, that actually it's not inevitable and it's not imminent? 2,000 years is nothing in terms of the stretch of eternity. We need to understand and receive that sense of now. I can't remember whether I've preached it here, but I've certainly spoken in the past about what would happen if you knew that Jesus was coming back in 5 minutes. What would you do? What if it was 5 hours? What if it was 5 days? What if it was 5 weeks? That kind of question helps you understand how you would respond differently if you knew that Jesus was coming back in 5 minutes. What your priority becomes changes as you understand when you think Jesus is coming back. What I'm saying is that we need to live in that sense of imminence. It doesn't mean that we don't plan for our future, because that is also something that Jesus asks us to do. But actually, that sense of urgency is something that we need to receive in our spirit. And I think that's part of what Paul is talking about here. Never be lacking in zeal. Keep your spiritual fervor. That spiritual fervor is just keep the spirit bubbling up within you. That's what Paul is talking about here. To grasp that sense of importance and urgency. Keep your spiritual fervor. It's also about recognizing that you are those You are the people who have been called to be agents of God's kingdom. You have been given permission. You have been given commission in order to go out into the world and help bring about Jesus' return. Isn't that what the kingdom is about? That actually it's our responsibility to participate and to bring the urge the kingdom in. Be people who invite the kingdom to come. I was reminded just on this little section about what I think is one of the most important prayers, and it's important because Jesus prays it. And it's Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, "My Father, if it's possible, take this cup away from me, and yet not my will, yet not as I will, but as you will." Again, what this little section recognizes is that actually we need to take responsibility for the things that we do. It's okay to have hopes and dreams, that we're to stay serving the Lord in that way, that we're to stay humble in that way, that we're to keep ourselves in a place of consistently seeking the Lord in everything that we would do. And actually diminishing, making it less about us and making it more about Him, that we're to be approach it in that way. And here's the prayer that helps us do that. It's okay to say to Father this, whatever it is, that I want to grow, I want to see this change, I want to see this done, I want to do this with you, I want to go this way, I want to see your kingdom come. And it looks like this, Lord, I think. But Jesus teaches us, and yet not as I will, but as you will. That's what it means to serve the Lord. It becomes less about us and more about Him. Never be lacking in zeal. Get on with it. Keep your spiritual fervor. That can only come out of a place of intimacy with Father. Serving the Lord, stay humble in it. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Okay, easy enough. Be joyful in hope. Celebrate the hope that you have in Jesus consistently. Endure suffering well. Again, this is the word translated here. It's one of my favorite Greek words and one of the only ones that I can ever remember. Makrothumia. Makrothumia is the one I always translate as patience. It's one that's listed as one of the fruits of the Spirit. What does it mean? Not necessarily patience as you know it, but it means long suffering. Long, big, makrothumia, suffering. It means that a long cry out of your heart, long suffering. That's what patience is. It's not a quick and temporary thing. It's not waiting for the kettle to boil. It's actually that process of having enough intimacy with God that we can long suffer with Him, that we can persevere with Him through some of the most challenging things of life. That's true. Patience, that's the spiritual gift of patience. But again, what's Paul writing about here? He's absolutely invoking the fruits of the Spirit, isn't he? Joy, faithfulness, patience. He's saying, here is how you will know that there is gift. These are things that you can find when you draw close to Him. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction. Suffer long in affliction. Do it consistently with God. Be faithful in prayer. That's a consistency in prayer. Again, it's a great challenge, isn't it? It's as Richard said last week, it's one of those challenges that you'd kind of wish, well, blimey, Paul, what were you talking about there? But it's that consistency in prayer. But what's this all about? I love this little triptych, isn't it? You've got these three things that are very much connected together. Again, it's all under this banner of genuine love. How do we work out all of these things? What's Paul saying? Is he saying it is inevitable that you will be afflicted? Is he saying that you must be afflicted? Is he saying any of those things? No. He's saying that you might suffer when you step out in terms of these ways. The affliction that he's talking about is actually probably talking about the things that you will suffer as a result of your faith. Those times when you step out in faith and it becomes a bit uncomfortable and you're faced with somebody who despises what you do. That's the kind of affliction that he's talking about here, probably. But what's it all about? He's saying, make sure that you are fixed in terms of the things that you are focused on. Fix your gaze upon the Lord. Fix your eyes upon the things that Jesus has done for you, because in those things, you cannot be let down. If you trust and if you look to the things that other people are doing, if you put your faith in other people, they will let you down. At some point, they will hurt you. If you trust in other people, you're likely to stumble. If you create your identity around the people that are around you, you will suffer from a lack of self-esteem. What's Paul saying? He's saying, look to Jesus Christ, because in him you can have joy at all times. If you hope in Jesus, that hope will not diminish and you will not be defined by anything else. You will be free from those shackles of hope that are placed in other people in our earthly relationships. When he says be patient in affliction, he means that actually there's a long way to go here, and the more that you trust in God, the more you may suffer. It's not that you will, but you may. When he's saying be consistent in prayer, hold yourself to Jesus Christ, draw him close. Because in that way, you will not stumble, you will not fall, you won't suffer in the same way. If we create our identity in him, if we recognize that we are his, then we will not struggle in the same ways. Share with those who are in need. If you've got it, give it. It's okay for you to do without. If you can manage without, then manage without. Practice hospitality. Again, look at all of these things under this banner of what does it mean to have genuine love? That we're to honor others, that we're to give to others, that we're to do without ourselves sometimes, that we're to practice hospitality. Hospitality to this early church was a deep and meaningful principle. Because hospitality is what gives somebody honor. It says that I honor you enough to share a precious family time, because the table was about family. Or was that the alarm for me to stop? That table was absolutely a place of, well, this is a place of, I accept you and I love you if I'm prepared to have you at my table. So when Paul says practice hospitality, he's saying this is how you give honor. This is how you share with one another. This is what you are to do in order to show one another genuine love. Genuine love is the banner. And here is how we know it. That it's all of the above. We don't get to pick and choose with these things, but this is how we know that it's genuine love. It's all of those things. And if you want to know how to work that out, what do you need to do? You look to the life of Jesus Christ, who was these things, who did these things, and who gave himself for you. Let's pray.